I'm David Marcus, host of Drinks with the Deal, and today my guest is Steve Kammerhort, the head of M&A at Paul Hastings. Steve, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, David. It's good to be here.
So we're going to talk about several things on today's podcast. First of all, a little bit about your background, how you came to practice law, then a subject of conversation for pretty much everyone in M&A land, Elon Musk and Twitter, the current state of tech and private equity, law firm competition in Silicon Valley, which has been a constant throughout your career as a lawyer. And then finally, your two kids who have engaged you in two very different kinds of parenting. So with that, tell us a little bit about yourself, how you came to practice law and came to practice M&A.
Sure. Thanks, David. And just to clarify, I have three kids, although the third one doesn't quite hit on the two topics we're going to hit. So I'm somewhat unusual in that I'm Bay Area born and bred. I was born in Berkeley while my father was finishing his PhD there. It's pretty amazing, actually, that my parents met and that I exist. He had grown up in the Philippines during World War II and was the first of his family to come to the U.S. to go to grad school at Berkeley. My mother was born in France as her family was fleeing Europe in 1940 and, you know, literally left the continent when she was 1 month old. And she grew up in New York City and they met in the Bay Area. So lucky for me. Growing up, as I said, we were only in Berkeley 2 years, but then we ended up moving to the peninsula, it's called, and particularly what is now called Silicon Valley, first in a town called Millbrae, but then since junior high in Sunnyvale, which is now one of the main cities in Silicon Valley. Back then, it was actually transitioning from fruit orchards to more residential and industrial. My father worked for decades at Lockheed Missiles and Space in Sunnyvale, which for those who've been down here, it's right next to where Moffett Field, a naval air station is. And it was by far the biggest employer in Santa Clara County, Silicon Valley, before, you know, Silicon Valley became what it is now. So it was interesting and fun to grow up in the area at a time of great transition. During all this time, I was not thinking of being a lawyer at all. I was a science, math-focused person. And then I ended up studying physics in college. And then I went to a PhD program in physics back east at Cornell. I was interested in theoretical particle physics, so not a practical kind of thing, more a pure academic track. And basically, like I think a lot of people who start down an academic path, whether it be in humanities or in these more esoteric areas of science where academia is essentially the only career path, I lost a bit of steam. I was maybe 2 years in. I had finished all the coursework, was in a research group, but what I was noticing was that, for example, the postdocs in the research group I was part of were going through their job process and their next job was turning out to be another postdoc. So the road was looking long and winding and uncertain. So I decided to do something different. And for better or worse, I vaguely remembered that law school was something that you didn't need any particular background for. I had really studiously avoided taking any classes that involved anything but science and math for even during my undergraduate years. So I hadn't really written much since maybe AP English in high school, but I figured I could pick that up. And also there was a bit of hubris. People in physics sort of assumed they were near the top of the food chain, as it were. So it was fun and disturbing to get to Berkeley Law and find a lot of smart people from a lot of different backgrounds. But so I tried patent law as my first couple jobs, a first summer job in law school, and then also a part-time job second year in law school. But yeah, the fact that my science math background was really almost purely math, to me at least, meant that I wasn't that engaged with inventions and practical things. So I sort of stumbled into corporate in some ways based on a pretty basic misconception about what litigators did. I premised my view of what litigators did on things like L.A. Law, this famous TV show back in the time, the 80s, which of course is very, very different than what the vast majority of big law litigators do.
But though, had you actually known what litigators do, it might have made you even less likely to go into litigation.
Right. Although it might not have been actually, because I still had this research mindset. So I still thought of research as a good thing, but it might not have, but who knows? I went down the path of corporate, and one amusing thing about my entry into the working world, which I like to joke, I literally spent the entire decade of the 80s in college. You know, 3 years of grad school, 3 years of law school, 4 years undergrad. But it was the third year of law school that finally had me enthused to start a real job. I had otherwise always just loved being in college. But the place I went initially was Sherman and Sterling, which was one of, I would say, the first two New York firms to be in the Bay Area. I think Skadden and Sherman both had gotten here, call it late 70s, early 80s. And I didn't do a summer there, but I did third year interviewing and decided to go there based on what was back then a startlingly large salary gap, but which will seem like background noise amongst today's salary wars. But at the time, a first year at a Bay Area firm would make $65,000 a year, and a first year at a New York firm would make, I think, 82. And then more importantly, in my sort of mathematical mind, gaps each year after that were 5,000 for San Francisco firms and 17,000 for New York firms. So it just seemed irrational to not at least initially try the New York firm. So I was a generalist initially, but then in 1993, I was newly married, and my wife and I both, for different reasons, wanted to give New York a try for a couple of years. I was going to go work at the mothership, and she was going to try freelance writing and the like. So we went back there, and that's really when I started focusing on M&A, because you could not be a generalist in a big multi-hundred lawyer New York central office. I picked M&A, which was very good timing. M&A had been in the down period in the early 90s, but was coming back in a big way in 93, 94. So I got some of that drink from the fire hydrant type training. And then when I got back to the Bay Area in late 94, tech M&A was really starting to take off. So I was able to focus from that point onward.
Just to give people a sense, so Netscape goes public, I believe, in 1995, which is a huge IPO. That this is the beginnings of the tech boom and ultimately bubble of the 90s. So initially, there's a lot of IPO work, but these companies are starting to buy and sell one another as well.
Yeah, so it's interesting. So I first became a partner when we left Sherman, sort of my mentor, you know, airlifted me into what was a firm that isn't anymore, Brobeck, which had been a mainline San Francisco firm, but had really jumped in with both feet into becoming a player in Silicon Valley and the tech sector. In contrast to the firms everyone's very familiar with, Wilson Sonsini, for example, that were pure play, that had been designed from the beginning to focus on the tech sector. And interesting thing about being someone that enjoyed and focused on M&A at the time was that you were the exception. You know, the corporate lawyers in Silicon Valley and the Bay Area at that time, whether it be partners, associates, everyone was, you know, sort of chasing the next startup because there was very heavy emphasis on the lawyers would get some of the founder stock or some of each round along the way, and amount would be divvied up. Some would go to the firms, you know, these firms' investment funds, but some would, you know, some finder's percentage would stick with the deal team. And it was a source of, you know, considerable income and wealth generation for people. So M&A, you know, you were sort of too late for that. If you were just arriving to do M&A deals, you weren't playing in that game, really. So when we went to Brobeck, and shortly thereafter, we got out of there before they went bankrupt, we spent time at Wilson Sonsini. But during that period, you know, both the run-up of the internet bubble and then the crash in the early 2000s, it was very hard to get associates, for example, who wanted to focus on M&A, and resources were very strained. So it was a tough time, but it was a good time for me because it was the case that it was a wide open field. When I was at Brobeck, for example, they literally just let me run with and lead the public M&A work for all their biggest public company clients because other people didn't want to do it. And, you know, I was 8-9 years out of law school. in this current environment, it would probably.
And those clients included Cisco. At the time, Cisco was just starting, and some of those deals were large, just starting to become a serial acquirer. And Broback was its law firm, correct?
That's right. I know Cisco, E-Trade, DoubleClick, there were some quite prominent companies. And again, I laugh looking at it now because Cisco, most of what they did were private deals, and there was a whole sort of team of people in our Palo Alto office that dealt with that. But as this 9-year lawyer, I got to kind of, I'm above that fray. Just call me in for the public M&A. So it was sort of a crazy time, but yeah, I learned a lot. I was working very, very hard, but yeah, learning a lot as those things often are correlated. So one thing that's relevant to our later conversation, the private equity versus corporates. So at Sherman, probably the anchor client of that office, one of the reasons it started was a company called Genstar, which originally was a Canadian conglomerate, but then it sort of got broken up and some of the top executives formed a buyout fund called, which survives to this day, Genstar Capital. So while I was at Sherman, you know, we did quite a bit of private equity. We took Genstar Capital with us to Brobeck, and yeah, we were very happy about doing that. But then when we went to Wilson Sonsini, this internet bubble was in full swing. We were doing very large in notional value stock for stock deals that could be done very, very quickly and be paid on sort of a value basis. You know, if that was going to last forever, that would have definitely been a better business model than sort of time and materials grinding it out for private equity. It didn't last forever, but we sort of foolishly let Genstar Capital go and never actually recovered them as a client, although the head of the firm lives literally on my block. We've known each other a long time. So there was a private equity period, then there was a corporate period, and then the internet bubble burst. And in the mid-2000s, we decided to leave Wilson and try and revive our private equity practice, which was sort of a bold move in retrospect, but it worked out incredibly well in the sense that that first year after we left Wilson Sonsini, we, in fact, you know, forged the three main private equity relationships that are the core of our little group in San Francisco's practice to this day, you know, 17 years later. And, you know, those kind of long-term relationships are very, you know, it's very hard to start them. So we happen to start three of them within a year of each other.
So does that speak to kind of the beginnings of PE investment in tech? Because of course, historically, PE was about, you know, remaking industrial companies. And the thinking for a number of years was tech companies actually don't really work for PE. And at some point, of course, the light bulb went on, at least for some people, and they realized that tech companies with recurring revenue models are, in fact, ideal for...
That's right. This period, call it 2005, the most well-known of the three that we work with a lot, Francisco Partners, had started relatively recently. It was sort of a combination of people from TPG, a more general big PE shop. There was Sandy Robertson, who was the Robertson of Robertson Stevens, one of the three. This is all ancient history now. There's sort of three horsemen, I think they call it, these tech-focused investment banks that did a lot of IPOs, but also M&A as well. So it was a coming together from different directions. How do we attack tech private equity? And as you say, a big part of that was just convincing investors and targets that the PE model made sense for tech companies at all. And I think the thing that has really, and this is fast forwarding quite a few years, that has really fast forwarded all of this dramatically is the software as a service, you know, SaaS software model, which was not really, this was before that, but that's what really has driven it home and made all the biggest private equity sponsors want to spend a lot of their time in this sector. Because as you say, that is recurring revenue. That's, you book it, you know, it's coming for years. So it's really a great financial model for private equity. But back then, that was far from it. And frankly, there were some ups and downs with private equity investments in more hardware type businesses did not necessarily go as swimmingly. So I think there was a period of time where people settled in on, I would say, almost every PE sponsor that says they focus on tech, almost all of them focused almost entirely on software now.
So was there a point where people at the private equity firms recognized that SaaS was a really phenomenal model for PE, or was it a more gradual awareness?
I think there was some of both, probably. And I think there's some funds that basically came in for the purpose of attacking that, and some that, as you know, were more the model I mentioned, where they had tried different things but came to understand that that was the ideal situation. So there was a variety of routes by which people got to that conclusion.
And now, of course, tech PE is it's a huge chunk of PE because, you know, so much of everything is tech, and a lot of that is kind of embedded technology, that the technology will be updated. The provider is very hard to displace.
That's right. And again, it's just a lot of it is software, and it's software has become so important even for many companies that you don't think of as tech companies. So you see those terms of corporate buyers, you'll see non-traditional tech buyers as well. So maybe just quickly wrapping up my little saga, we revived the private equity part of the business, our personal business, that is. Although the other partners I work with, I think we're very happy to be what I think has become more the norm, focused almost entirely on private equity. But I've always just enjoyed both of those strands, working with corporates, working with investment banks. I like to work with investment banks. You don't have to spend as much time on any particular deal, but you get to see the most interesting issues on more deals. Since that time, that's continued to be basically the three private equity, corporates, and investment banks. And it just continues to be a great time to do that type of work in the Valley.
Talk to me a little bit about Twitter and Elon Musk, which is probably the most prominent M&A situation this year, and one of the ones that's been most widely watched in a number of years.
Yeah, so it's interesting. Yeah, obviously, I'm not involved in it, so I'm basing what I'll say on reading publicly available documents. It sort of captures a few different threads. One, which is disconcerting to deal lawyers, is that sometimes the practical reality of a situation isn't particularly driven by the wonderful contract you negotiated. So people look at Musk's behavior and his sort of threatening behavior. A lot of it is based on facts or allegations that I think most M&A lawyers would say, even if he proved those to be true, that doesn't actually give him any right to exit the contract. So all the thing about fake accounts, bots, my impression, again, from the outside, is that I'm sure that's always been part of their makeup and their financial results, that he basically agreed to a price based on, reflect that fact. And it doesn't seem to me he's saying that there's something fundamentally different about the company from when he signed on to buy it for a certain price. He's saying that there are characteristics of it that did exist that he doesn't like, which does not trigger a material adverse change by any stretch of the imagination. The other things he's thinking about or potentially pointing to, one, a lot of the potential theories for someone to get out of a deal came up during COVID. So one is material adverse effect, which I think everyone would agree is the hardest for a buyer to invoke. Not impossible. I guess there was the one, but that was not something that any of the COVID cases where the buyer got any traction. One, secondly, there's covenant breach. I think, again, everyone on both sides would agree is an easier route because you don't have that Delaware case law about material adverse effect. The closing conditions typically characterized simply as if they don't materially comply with their covenants, you can walk. So there certainly are interpretive issues about what that means, but it's definitely a lower bar than material adverse effect. And in COVID, yeah, there was a lot of discussion about, is that consistent with past practice? Is that what the contract says? Does that mean if the world dramatically changes such that past practice has to be different, that the seller's inherently breaching. And I think the COVID case has had a lot of very specific outcomes depending on the language in each contract. And until today, I would have said that didn't seem to be what he was particularly focused on either. But today there was a very interesting filing or update on that, which is, you know, he files a letter saying that, you know, they're resisting his request to see various information about this fake account point. And, you know, he basically says he's reserving his rights because they have an obligation to provide us that information. And therefore, they're materially breaching their obligation to provide information. And this highlights to me one of the frustrating things. I've been in the seller shoes during COVID where there really isn't a good argument, but the buyer is saber rattling anyway. And one frustrating aspect of that is, you know, to me, the best course in that setting, if you're the seller, is still to be extremely cooperative with this annoying buyer who's taking various threatening actions. So you've got these very obtrusive operating covenants. You've got this information sharing, which is typically, and in the Twitter contract, is phrased quite broadly. So it can be very frustrating for the seller who's being jerked around by a recalcitrant buyer to, at the same time, feel obligated to keep cooperating because you don't want to give this easier covenant breach out exit. But then the third thing that came up a lot in COVID, and I think is the most relevant thing in Twitter, is this model related to primarily when financial sponsors do take private. So how do you deal with financing risk? And an interesting thing about the Twitter contract is that it very clearly followed the model that financial sponsors follow, which is there's what's called limited specific performance. The parties agree that specific performance is an appropriate remedy if the financing is available. And if it's not available, then the seller cannot force the buyer to close. They have to be content with a reverse termination fee. And that's exactly what the Twitter contract says. There are two flavors of that in my mind. For financial sponsors, that reverse termination fee, which in the case of Twitter is $1 billion, sort of an Austin Powers vibe there, $1 billion. But that's their maximum cash exposure, regardless of whether it's a sort of inadvertent breach or anything up to a willful breach. He has no more cash damages exposure than that. And I think, especially if it's, say, a corporate buyer that's using debt financing to do a deal, I think it's more common for that cap not to be there, that there's the overhang of specific performance or money damages that aren't necessarily capped. So to me, it's a significant win for Musk in his contract that he's on this sponsor type model. Now, that doesn't go to whether he could in fact succeed in getting a specific performance judgment. It's a little interesting to contemplate that depending on how far along he takes things before he just stops being cooperative. I don't know exactly where they are, and I know HSR cleared. I don't know where they are, and his financing plans are pretty complicated with various debt and equity sources. So even though I think Delaware judges generally do want to respect the party's contractual decision to allow for specific performance, I think they might get a little more reluctant if there's still three more months of work that needs to be done and they need to oversee. So that possibility, even if it's a low probability that the judge takes that view, will weigh on the Twitter board's mind as to how to deal with his threats. I saw that another very significant deal, Anaplan, just announced a couple percent price reduction. This was a Thoma Bravo as the buyer. So I haven't read anything about the background of that, but I just know from personal experience that, you know, in the seller's shoes, there can definitely be situations where even though you are 100% certain of your position, no litigator is ever going to tell you you have a 100% probability of success. And sometimes that can lead to these better part of valor type outcomes.
There, I think the price cut was, as you said, maybe 5% on that order. So what do you think happens in the Twitter Musk drama?
The other factor with the Twitter must drama, which sort of jumps off the page when you read the background section, in addition to the sort of very painful to contemplate factoid that they literally did their deal documents in one day from serving them up and to the next day signing. But there's another factor, and I think this is also, people see this in Musk's dealings with securities law filings and the like. Even if you were to negotiate a revised agreement, it's not clear how much stock he puts in complying with his agreements or his obligations. Yeah, that ironically might be something that drives more of a binary outcome where Twitter just says, this is not a normal situation. We're not going to get any added certainty if we agree to a reduced price. Let's just fight it out now. The fight is coming at some point. Let's fight it out now at the highest price. So that would be my guess, but who knows?
So clearly, just as an observer who does not have a dog in the fight, you find this just a fascinating situation.
Oh, for sure. Because I think all of us who've been doing M&A for a while have had various bits of this in different situations, but not at the scale and not all of them together. So, I have a situation now with a counterparty that takes a little bit of the what are you going to do, sue me kind of approach to life. And I've dealt with it before and it's frustrating, but you add to it some of these other aspects of public M&A and risk of closures. It's all in one place. It's all very high profiles. And plus, I know all the main lawyers working on it are people I know very well. So it does make for an entertaining situation from afar.
You talked a fair amount about this earlier in the podcast. The legal landscape in San Francisco and Silicon Valley, which at the beginning of your career were really separate legal markets and have only really become a single legal market in the last 10 years. Even 20 years ago, they were fairly disparate. As you look out at that market now, what do you see?
It's interesting. During the course of my career, there have been a few different waves of, I guess I'll call them invaders, for lack of a better word. As I said, I started in 89, where there was really just Skadden and Sherman. The LA firms were also here, but much, much smaller in the Bay Area than they are now. The next big influx, I'd say, came around that late 90s, 2000 point in time, where Davis Polk, Sullivan and Cromwell, Simpson Thatcher, some very big names all came in roughly the same time and 1 year before the internet bubble burst. However, they're still there to this day in varying sizes. And then since then, there have been a lot of different firms coming in over the years. But in the last year or two, there's been another pretty concentrated influx, both with UK firms, strangely. I didn't mention the infamous Clifford Chance, California experiment when they basically picked up a bunch of what was the last gasp of Brobeck and opened five California offices at once. And that did not go well. But now I think Freshfields, A&O, and Linklaters have all kind of descended upon us in a relatively short period, as well as quite a few New York firms for the first time, Cleary, Debevoise, Paul Weiss. So again, big names, some of whom have had pretty good practices out here already without necessarily being on the ground. I don't want to be negative. In some ways, it could almost be similar to the last time in the sense that I think some of their decisions were made during last year or the year before when that period of, call it a year and a half post the initial few months of COVID where things were just booming. And my impression is, there are a fair number of things that are not booming at the moment. SPACs, for example, were a ridiculous sort of money generator for law firms, including Silicon Valley firms, which had a lot of the private targets that took advantage of SPACs as an alternative way to the public market. That's clearly not booming, but IPOs, M&A is down. So hopefully it's not going to be a prolonged period like the internet bubble bursting right after Davis Polk, Sullivan, Cromwell, Simpson arrived, but you don't know. On the other hand, I think part of why these people are coming isn't necessarily that driven by that part of the business. I think quite a few of them, in fact, are focused on private equity, but also I think almost all of them have quite a bit of focus on sort of a global regulatory practice in terms of big tech, and they're very relentless and time-consuming and expensive struggles with various regulators around the world, especially Europe. So I'm fairly certain that's a big driver of the UK firms, but not just the UK firms, the New York firms as well. So it just makes for a market that is always evolving. No one's quite put their finger on exactly what the best way to do it is. It's very hard to hire laterally out of the local firms with any confidence of what business is going to stick to the platform and what business is going to go where. So it's an interesting time.
But certainly from a talent retention perspective, it has to make life more challenging for everybody, because there's just more demand for associates, for partners, lawyers.
No, for sure. And for specialists, for example, I think one of your sister periodicals wrote an article recently about specialists, you know, executive comp, tax, those sorts of people suddenly being very in demand, because the out-of-town firms definitely know that's part of the secret sauce of successfully attacking this market. And there's just a pretty small pool of that talent. So it is challenging for all of us, both on a, you know, those of us, you know, we still want to be a relentless acquirer. So we're out there competing in that way. But you know, you also have to always, of course, be on defense in terms of retaining your talent. So it is definitely tough.
So how do you play defense?
And to me, there's a couple factors. You know, one is the money factor, which at a certain point, you can't expect other factors to overcome it if it becomes too big. But then you do hope that the other factors, the sort of, you know, if we're talking about specialists, for example, the way in which you empower them to really forge enriching relationships with your clients and long-term relationships, and then the way in which you work together as a team, you hope that those sort of intangibles make it a little harder for them to say, oh, I'll just go somewhere else and start from scratch on all of that. But there's only so much of a money difference that sort of thing can really realistically prevail on. So it is hard.
And then finally, your kids.
Yeah, so I have listened to your podcast and people talk about their other interests. And again, I don't want to project, but I think for people in our sort of busy career, if you do have kids, I think a lot of your weekends are devoted to what they want to do. And as you mentioned, two of my three kids have interests that fortunately align nicely with my own interests. So on the one hand, it sounds a little embarrassing to say, you know, your kids' interests are your hobbies, but it's sort of a practical reality. So one, all of my kids have done sports in one form or another. And I think the sports parent activity on weekend is very known to a lot of us. And it's interesting in that my three kids have done it in different ways. My oldest was very focused on one sport from maybe high school on, soccer. She did it at a very high level in high school, but then she was the more mature part of our team in that she decided to go to Columbia, where she was not going to play soccer, as opposed to some call it D3 schools where she could have played soccer. So even though her father was a little sad about that, that was clearly the sophisticated, correct choice. My one son, my middle kid, is at the other end of the spectrum in terms of not focusing on any one sport. He's like the old fashioned, he probably played literally five or six different sports in high school, you know, without really digging in deeply into any one of them, which is fun in and of itself. And then my youngest, she found a small sport where she's done extremely well, rowing. She competed for the U.S. and junior world championships twice, won a gold medal in Bulgaria last summer for the U.S. doing that. She's now a freshman at Stanford, and they just finished NCAAs where they came in second for the second year in a row, which is very good, but also a little frustrating, but that's fun as well. And so I've become surprisingly knowledgeable about various things like rowing and soccer. But on a more intellectual end of the spectrum, my oldest, the one who just graduated from Columbia, she majored in Slavic studies and is now going to go get a master's in comparative literature. And she always has been an incredibly voracious reader. And again, it's a little embarrassing that when I need a book recommendation, I basically go to my child. But that's how it's been for quite a few years, because she has a very eclectic interest in a lot of different literature from around the world, whether it be Chile, Roberto Bolaño. She has all his books on her shelf. She's already texting with professors at her graduate school about Bolaño or Eastern European Slavic literature or all sorts of other European literature. And she's also an organizer. So her room, which she doesn't really live in anymore, it's like a library. You know, if I need a new book, I just get an instruction of where to go on her shelf to pick up something new. So
what has she had you reading over the past couple of weeks or month?
Well, I raised this, but then this is anticlimactic because what I've actually been reading most recently is not one of her recommendations. It's something she would never read. It's this sort of futuristic writer, Neal Stephenson from Seattle, that I've read a lot of. So he has a new book out about, he's very good at near science fiction, not like hundreds of years in the future, but maybe 30 years in the future. So the main focus is climate change, and it's extremely good, but it's not one of hers.
Steve, thank you so much for joining us.
No, thanks for having me. It was fun.
For Drinks with a Deal, I'm David Marcus.